August 23rd, 2008, the Norris Group is hosting the event I Survived Real Estate 2008 at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California. Proceeds from the event will benefit the Orange County affiliate of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure. The event seeks to bring together the real estate community, including realtors, auctioneers, investors, mortgage professionals, economists, data providers, and builders to discuss how we got here, how the respective industries are changing, and how we move forward and prosper together in 2008 and 2009. The event would not be possible without the generous help of the following partners: the San Diego Creative Investment Association and President Bill Tan, the Investors Workshops of Orange County and President Sean Watkins, Fry Wiles, the web development, internet marketing, and creative design firm, helping launch the event site isurvive2008.com, Proxibid, who will be airing the event live over the internet for those unable to attend live, the Nixon Library, our good friends at MVT Productions, who always take care of our audio-video needs, and White House Catering, whose master chef will be providing the three-course meal for this black tie event. The following radio interview is in preparation for the live event.
Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest is Joel Singer. He is the Executive Vice President for the California Association of Realtors. Joel has held the association's top staff position since November 1989 after serving as Carr's chief economist and heading the association's public affairs department. He joined Carr in 1978. Joel, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
From 2002 to 2006, the volume of sales in California exploded and prices kept escalating. How big a role did easy financing play in California's boom market?
Oh, I'd have to say it was by far the number one factor in terms of facilitating the very high volume of sales. We reached levels in the almost mid 600,000 units transacted on the existing home market annually, and of course over 200,000 units, including multifamily units, on the new home market. Those are levels that are very, very high. They're not high in comparison to other places, but given our constraint and affordability, those were very, very high levels, and only could have occurred with a dramatic loosening in lending standards.
Do you think that had the same effect on how high the prices ended up getting?
No question. Again, you were in a position, and we've seen this at least twice in my career in the late 70s and for a period in the late 80s as well, where it becomes you're almost incented to buy. The question is, not can you afford to buy, but can you afford not to buy, because the price for waiting, of course, is that the housing will become less affordable. And part of that was, of course, the incredible demand, both the first-timer and the trade-up market, by cheap money, not only cheap money, but money that really went beyond traditional lending standards in terms of borrower security, down payment. And in fact, when you had so much of the financing being 100% financing, without skin in the game, you almost incented people to speculate.
Especially in California, we have a non-recourse state.
That's true. For initial financing on the purchase money situation, it is non-recourse. So that also, again, created the environment that I think was singular and unique, and we probably won't see again. Probably shouldn't see again.
No, probably shouldn't. Did we create kind of creative financing in those years? The end of the 70s, the end of the 80s. Did the price booms of those eras also, were they accompanied by some kind of financing that was easier than what was normal?
Well, it was in an odd sense. In the 80s, the cost of, in the late 70s, let's say, the cost of a mortgage was fairly high. A 9%, 10% mortgage was fairly affordable. But relative to inflation, you had negative real rates of interest. So it was affordable in that sense. But what's different, and we've been tracking, particularly for existing homes, we've been tracking the characteristics of borrowers since the late 70s. But even then, even though housing finance was underpriced. It was almost negative, and certainly after tax was negative relative to inflation rates. You still had fairly considerable down payments. It was very normal. I think our standard down payment in the early 80s was a 20% down payment. A couple of 3 years ago, the down payment on average for the first-time buyers had descended below 5%, and that was really unprecedented. And then beyond that, the borrower quality questions. When you have loans where no documentation is the norm, whereas back in the 70s and 80s, you very clearly had to document your ability to repay the loans. That really all contributed to what we saw over the last 5-6 years.
Do you think the lenders now have swung the pendulum too far to the other side, making it too difficult to buy a house?
I think that's the consequence of what's occurred. Now, I don't know if it's exactly, you know, the lender's fault as such. I think the ability to finance a loan has long been dependent not just on lenders, but on secondary and tertiary financial markets. And the financial markets at this point, even though the quality of new loans that are coming out in the last 6 months is dramatically better than it's been for the last 5 years, the financial community is just not buying it.
So that's
it becomes,
right.
So it becomes very, very difficult to originate at this point. And the criteria have certainly become very, very stringent as they were probably 10 or 15 years ago. And that is going to have a rain shadow effect, if you will, on constraining sales.
I've been an investor since about 1980, and this last run-up in price from 97 to pretty much early 07 was the longest boom I ever saw. Do you think the experience of the buyer in that decade kind of blinded them to the risk of borrowing money?
Absolutely. And again, I think that, you know, there are two things. One, you know, the assumption that the prices will always go up. And number two, you had a whole series of things occurring that incented lenders and Wall Street to create incredibly favorable mortgage loan patterns. There were a whole series of fee-generated events that made it everybody's short-term interest to originate loans that weren't safe, originate loans at costs that may have even been below the long-term cost of money, and all of that created the situation.
Yeah, when you combine that we had a 40-year low interest rate and the most generous qualifying standards ever, we ended up with exactly what probably was a no-brainer, the explosion of all times.
Absolutely, and financial markets were overpaying for that. And then again, if you look at the deep end, where you're creating all sorts of new instruments, you know, from CMOs to CDOs and tranching everything and getting a fee, the securities industry, along with the banks and the traditional lenders, were certainly contributing to that kind of frenzy.
I think part of the process is that we're thinking that it's good for everyone to own a home. And looking back, have we learned that maybe not everyone's supposed to own one?
Well, I think it is good for everyone to own a home, everyone who can afford to own a home.
Okay.
And I think that caveat has long been lost. Again, you really don't want to put someone in a home when they can't qualify for it and can't maintain home ownership over time. Because otherwise, those people who got into housing, they were basically speculating on future price appreciation and the ability of price increases to bail them out. That's not a good basis for home ownership.
The word that you just used, I've heard a lot of blame placed on speculation for the boom, yet I usually get the sense it was directed to not the owner-occupant, but an investor or other. So what do you think, if you were going to say the blame is looking like this group or another group, is it predominantly that extra, say, 6 or 7% of the households that became homeowners, were they really more the speculator than the investor?
I think speculation was throughout the marketplace. From the institutions that lent the money, they were speculating, to people who were on the margins who decided to take a chance on homeownership, to the flippers. And obviously the degrees of speculation vary, but the people who should have known better created an environment that led to much of the speculation. So it's hard to fault anyone for taking a chance. And again, if you look at it from the perspective of it's going to get worse and I'll never be able to afford a home, you can certainly understand the incentive of people who wanted to get in and take a chance on home ownership. I actually understand that part.
Absolutely.
I actually understand that part pretty well. It's the institutions that created that environment that makes me scratch my head.
You know, what you just said is very true. You have a lot of very experienced people running the show, and how they thought that was going to come out well is rather amazing, because we ended up with a median price that was almost 9.5 times our median income.
I agree. And again, as I say, there's a whole series of things we can look at, and you mentioned a lot of Bruce. But the fact of the matter is the environment was heavily tilted towards people making rational short-term decisions that in the long term were clearly dangerous.
The raising of the FHA loan limits, how important was that to California?
Well, I think anything right now that creates the only mortgage financing occurring at this point is government-supported in almost in one way or the other. Traditionally, if you look at it, Fannie and Freddie hold about 50% of all the mortgage securities and mortgage financing originated in the U.S. At the moment, and I'm just estimating, together with FHA, they're probably accounting of upwards of 85 or even 90%. Because investors are not interested, the non-government-sponsored conduits are basically not originating loans. So it's very, very important because it does extend the market to the 729,000 level, and that's the only support that market's getting. In fact, you can kind of see that the weakest markets in California, there's been some recovery at the very low end, the weakest markets in California, that level above 750,000 to about 1.5 million, where mortgage financing is virtually non-existent.
And what happens, I think, when you don't have financing for that price range, the price range tends to go down until you find financing.
Absolutely.
So you end up having big price hits where you didn't think you were going to get them.
Yeah, and you know, in the past, there was enough equity created where people could do some seller financing, and sometimes that made a lot of sense. But seller financing is very, very difficult in an environment where prices are falling so rapidly.
Now that you brought up seller carry back financing, I did some research one time, and the years between 81 and 82, where interest rates were very high, about 50 to 60% of the transactions for California in those years moved financing forward by simple assumptions that FHA once had.
Right.
What do you think of an idea where they go back to something like that, to where anybody that can legitimately make the payment doesn't have to qualify, but they can just take over the ownership?
I think it's unlikely.
But would it be a good idea? Yeah, I think it's unlikely, too.
You know, it depends. I was involved very heavily in that what used to be called the Wellenkamp Wars. Wellenkamp was a court decision that allowed people to, in California, to assume loans that were originated by state-chartered lenders and banks. We attempted to maintain that because, as you say, it was more than half the financing in the early 80s, and it was phased out by the Garn-St. Germain Act in the mid-1980s. So you can't assume a loan any longer. I do think that there are a lot of creative approaches and things that ought to occur to keep people in their homes, but I don't think I would be in favor of simple assumptions, because the variable nature of those loans is such that it's probably not an efficient way of dealing with a problem that needs to be aggressively dealt with.
FHA has a couple of programs that they've discontinued, or one of them in particular they discontinued that would be a big help in this market. They have a 203K loan program where the financing for the rehab accompanies the purchase price, but they only have that for owner-occupied. If they gave that to investors, they'd end up having a lot more of these homes moved, I think. So
I tend to agree with you, but I know FHA is trying to be consistent. They found that they have tremendous high rates of default when there's no skin in the game. They're a 3% down payment program. Nehemiah seems to be their target, which is a very important program in terms of moving inventory at this point. So I think they're going to have to kind of reestablish their basis. I would hope that the moment housing prices show any signs of stabilization, they'd look at these types of programs more creatively, because if the investment is actually made in the property, it tends to work very well for the investor, it tends to work very well for the FHA, it tends to work very well for the next buyer. But I understand why they're reluctant, and again, in a market where you do have prices falling so quickly, there an argument can be made to suspend that program, but I'm hoping it's a suspension, not a permanent withdrawal. Because the FHA, you know, those programs have proven in normal markets to work well. Unfortunately, this is not a normal market.
Correct. Do you, those FHA loan limits thus far are temporary. Do you envision they will become permanent?
They will be increased from where they were And, you know, my suspicion is they'll be increased to at least $625,000. But the bills that are designed to do that are very contentious. I'm hopeful it'll be $625,000. We think it should stay at the normal levels. There may be other ways let me rephrase that. I'm confident it'll be at least $625,000, whereas we used to be at $417,000 or three in the 380s. But I'm very hopeful it'll be higher than that, and we're certainly going to do anything we can to make sure it stays high.
Okay. In the boom years, inventory levels reached below 3 months in California. How are the inventory levels doing right now?
Well, they've come down, but they're still very high. We're looking at, in most marketplace between and in most price sectors, between 8 and 10 months of inventory. We normally think a balanced market is somewhere between 5 and 7 months. 4 to 7 months is a balanced market. And you're right, during the very hottest seasons, we had some markets where you had less than a month's supply, which, of course, was a classic seller's market. But the inventories are off their peaks. There's indications that they'll continue to decline. But there, of course, it's highly variable by market. If you're in Riverside, San Bernardino, or the Central Valley, there's a tremendous amount of inventory in the REO and distressed property classifications, and that has an impact as well. But those are being liquidated reasonably fast. And in fact, our sales activities are up pretty sharply from the bottoms we experienced in the fourth quarter.
Absolutely. Do you see the decline in inventory levels as a healthy sign, or have private sellers just pulled their homes from the market and are waiting for the foreclosure phase to pass?
I think it's both, but I think it is healthy. I think a lot of civilian sellers, as we call them, who don't need to sell, have pulled their homes from the marketplace, and that's a rational action, obviously,
yes,
in this marketplace. But I think what we're seeing is the first signs of recovery. You have to have an impact on inventory, and with sales activity going up, particularly in the low end for first-time buyers, that makes me a little more confident that we're in the recovery phase now. Now, we're not certainly through it by any stretch of the imagination, but it seems pretty clear that the recovery has begun in California. And the real question is, when do we get to the point where the market stabilizes and starts heading upwards? And I think we're still looking at a few months before that occurs.
In October of 2007, in a projection for 2008, a car projected a median price to be around $540,000. We're now at about $385,000. Is that $385,000 an accurate picture of what happened to price, or has the mix of what's selling dramatically changed?
Absolutely. The problem with the median price is that the mix influences it dramatically. When we put that number out, what had occurred, if you think back to early 2007 and particularly late 2006, is that the bottom end had started to dry up already. There were very few sales in the bottom end. The only sales occurring were really in the above the median price categories. That had an effect of inflating the median price for the last year or two of the boom in 2005, 2006, early 2007. Now, as you see the reversal where the hottest markets are the very low-end markets, it's had the opposite effect. Most neighborhoods are seeing price decreases on the order of, it really depends. If you're in one of the distressed areas, you could argue that the peak to valley price decreases have been 40-45% in some radical situations. But if you're in a well-established neighborhood, particularly a neighborhood where there's been almost no new construction, it's also not atypical to see that you're down less than 10% from the peak. So the median price is what it is. It's a gross indicator of what's happened in the state, and it is certainly subject to distortion because of either high proportion of high-end or low-end sales, and that's what we're seeing now.
We're investors in the Riverside area, and one of the harder-hit areas is the Moreno Valley. And in the last 40 days, we've purchased 20 houses. The lenders were owed something around $6.7 million on those homes. We paid $2.1
million. Wow.
That is,
wow.
31% is what the lenders ended up with getting. And the properties are probably worth, when we fix them and resell them, it'll probably be at 50% of the former high value.
Yeah, I think the Moreno Valley, again, with a few other areas, is about as hard to hit as you could find through the state.
Yes.
But that is, to me, a really unusual situation, even in Bakersfield through Sacramento, where you look at the Central Valley. I think 45% from peak is pretty normal, but you're talking about more than that, and that's not the norm.
No,
it's a great buy for you and your investors, I suspect.
Well, I hope so. Well, that's the thing. We're taking some risks because what we thought it was worth 60 days ago has changed dramatically, and that's. It kind of brings up a question. I felt bad for a gentleman. I bought this one house recently for $84,000. I went to just go secure it, and the lender was owed $365,000 on this house.
Jeez.
And when I went there, the guy next door was watering his yard, and I really thought, I wonder what he owes. I wonder how he would feel if he knew somebody just bought a house next door to him for less than $100,000.
Well, that's. Unfortunately, that's what happens in these types of steep downturns. And I must say, we've never seen one quite this steep.
No.
But typically, as the spiral deepens, one of the reasons it gets worse and accelerates is because people do look at the person next door. The classic used to be in a condo complex where Fannie or Freddie would come in and auction five or six foreclosed units, and then they'd be very happy they got rid of their inventory. And the next week, someone would send them in eight sets of keys because people finally realized that they were so far underwater. And we do have a little bit of that, but most people are willing to continue their payments if they can. They understand that it is a long-term investment, and it's not rational economic decision-making because the rational decision may be, in fact, to walk away. Most people don't do that, however.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, I agree.
There's been a lot of talk about ways to rescue people who are losing their homes. What would you like to see done in that regard?
Well, I do think the bills moving through Congress are good initiatives. There's going to be a lot of money being placed on specific targeted situations, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the voluntary efforts that have been organized previously have had some successes as well. I think there's a lot of incentive for institutions to keep people in their homes under virtually any circumstances if they're willing to make what is a reasonable payment. My sense is both these private initiatives, these voluntary initiatives, and the we're talking about billions of dollars, over $300 billion in the one bill that is likely to be passed in the next week or so, being directed towards foreclosures, will have some impact. But when all is said and done, we're going to see the number of foreclosures reach unprecedented levels. It's already at unprecedented levels.
That's right.
But I also think the resilience of the marketplace, particularly in California, where it's difficult to build, it costs a great deal to build, where the economy is still a well-balanced economy, and over the long run, you've got significant demographic growth, means that you will get a recovery. But it's very, very painful, and my heart goes out to those people who've lost their homes.
Yeah, it is a very tough thing to go through. Any unintended consequences to some of the programs they're suggesting?
I think there's always going to be some unintended consequences, but by and large, this is not going to change the major flow. It's going to be mostly advantageous to those individuals who really were in a situation where they could afford to buy a home, but because of the nature of the loan they took, or because of other short-term reverses, or because of the sharp drop in prices, would now be in a foreclosure situation. It's really going to only have an impact on the margins when all is said and done. So the unintended consequences, from my standpoint, are not that great. And I don't believe that people are going to, speculate with their credit or speculate just generally because they think the government will bail them out. I think there will be far more people who aren't bailed out to those who are able to cut some sort of deal. And when all is said and done, I think the unintended consequences are going to pale in comparison with the lesson that has been learned.
What category of statistics do you look for to say, okay, now we have reached the bottom, we are going to go the other way?
Well, it's hard to call a bottom. I mean, from a sales activity level in the fourth quarter of last year, we were well under 300,000 units of existing homes being sold annually. The last couple of months, we've been over 400,000. So I think from a standpoint of unit sales, we probably did see the bottom. However, price drops continue to be very, very significant. So the overall volume real estate that's being sold is dramatically down, and even with the increase that I'm talking about, which is really well over a well over 35%, 40% even from the bottom. We're not seeing much increase in total dollar volume. So, again, I think the bottom in activity has been reached, but I wouldn't call this market a market in full recovery yet. There's just too much pressure and too much stress in terms of ongoing foreclosures, constrained capital, and price depreciation for me to call it a market in full recovery.
Well, Joel, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed our talk and look forward to you being part of our panel August 23rd.
Great talking to you, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.